Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
RPG, two new coaches on the roster. We keep our numbers low to ensure the quality stays high. And we have had a few coaches knocking on the door saying, I'd love to work with you. And we found two amazing candidates. So if anyone's looking for one-on-one coaching, please reach out to info@rpgcoaching.com. You will chat to either Tim or myself, and we can steer you in the right direction for the perfect coach for you.
That's right, Clint. And also, we have the Performance Pass up and running. It is for $25 a week. You have access to the RPG membership and all of my pre-built programs that are available for sale in the Training Peaks library. Instead of having to decide on which one to use, you can pick and choose, you can combine plans, and you can even email me and say, hey, I need a plan for this and there isn't something in the list that fits, and I will build it out for you, provided I think that other people will need it down the line as well. Also, this podcast is very much brought to you by Chief Nutrition, which is regeneratively farmed meat snacks, which we are now going to stock in the RPG shop because I think it's super hard for athletes to get their protein needs without having to take on highly processed supplements. So we're going to stock it. And as a bonus to you guys, we're going to do a 15% discount off everything in the shop. It will be Triathlon Therapy 15 for 1 month. The Chief stuff will be in there in a few days. So don't check it today, depending on when the podcast goes out. Give it a few days. It'll all be up soon. Take 15% off and enjoy some healthy snacks that will really provide a lot more than just some whey protein powder. Vitamins, minerals, all that sort of thing. Anything else? Oh, we do need to mention from Steve McKenna, who is a part of this podcast occasionally. What have we got? I said, what do you need us to promote?
And he wrote back and said, who's this?
Yeah. New designs arriving. Trail vests are coming. They've got, he writes long messages.
For nerd belts.
Yeah, for nerd belts.
Trail vests for nerd belts.
We've got, oh man, it's so hard with Steve. He just makes life difficult. No. Anyway, just check their website. They've got new stuff coming soon. I still have some nerd belts in the RPG shop too. I don't think many people have them around the country at the moment because there was such a big uptake. This advertisement section has gone way too long. Let's get it started.
Hello, come in. Lie down. Relax. Take a deep breath in. And now breathe out. We'll be your therapists today. You're listening to Triathlon Therapy.
That's too much time. Look at Steve McKenna. Steve, what are you doing, Steve? That's too much time. Advantage Reed.
Guys, we are back. I I owe both you, Clint, and Apo a huge apology. I'm really sorry about this. We've got one of these, there's this bloke, and he has been pestering me nonstop to come on the podcast. Just like every day, I think I get a message. He thinks that, you know, because we are probably the most popular triathlon website out there, and just because he's, you know, three-time Ironman world champ, you know, probably over 100 pro victories, multiple Australian Sportsman of the Year, voted triathlete of the decade, all these things. He thinks that he's good enough to come on our podcast and keeps asking. Actually, the biggest award I saw was voted 365 times most handsome male triathlete of the year by Clint Rollings every time we have that vote. Quite genuinely, Crowy, when I looked through your list of accolades, as much as I was getting a bit over you asking to come on, I was like this. We were sort of saving you because we knew that you are, you know, probably the greatest of all time in many people's opinion, and it's such an honour to have you on. Not just one of the greatest triathletes, but one of the greatest humans going around. So, Crowy, and to be honest, you only asked me once, how do you get on this show? But that's enough for me. I was flattered. So thank you for coming on, Crowy.
Mate, I can't believe it's taken you guys so long to invite me on. I've been hitting you up. I mean, you are, without question, not probably, without question, you guys are the biggest tri podcast. And actually, I think I sent you a message saying, who have you got a shag to get on here? So,
well, enough about man crushes and historical results. No offense, Crowy, but we've also got the king of Boise on here, Sam Appleton. Another win on the weekend. What's happening? How are you, mate?
I'm good, mate. Tim, in that intro, you probably missed Crowy's two biggest results. Second place at Cairns and Vineman in 2015. I can't actually remember who won those races, Crowy, but I think you were second at both Cairns and Vineman a month or two apart. Pretty big results in my eyes, mate.
Mate, I'll take full credit for kickstarting your pro career, mate. And you know damn well who won those races. It was you. And mate, congratulations on Boise. Maybe we've put that retirement back another year or two, have we?
We'll see, mate. We'll see. It's good to get another win, but you know, I'm under no I know Boise's not the biggest race on the calendar. It's just it was an easy flight from Boulder, and it's good to get another win, you know. And I think, you know, just keep a bit of presence. The sponsors love to see someone holding up a banner, regardless of the race. Regardless of his world champs or if it's Boise 70.3. But man, I think you've won that race as well. I think I was looking back in the archives. You had a pretty famous sprint finish there with Chris Lieto.
Did the archives go back that far today?
My memory went back that far. I informed Apo because I was there, but yeah, it was probably pre-internet.
Well, mate, like you say, it was a good race to do when you're based in Boulder, short flight, same time zone. When they actually announced the race, they flew me out for the announcement, and I did a run along the Greenbelt there, and I thought this would be a beautiful race to do. So I went back and did it. And I loved it. I'm not sure if it's an afternoon start these days, but it used to be a 2 p.m. Start out at Lucky Reservoir, I think. Is it Lucky Peak Reservoir?
Yeah, beautiful spot.
Yeah, great spot. And you ride through, is it that wildlife reserve or the, I'm not sure. The old course used to go through this reserve, but it was, yeah, I got a couple of good memories from those two races. Firstly, the first year, this thunderstorm hit. Lightning and thunderstorm during the bike ride. And I think they were going to actually cancel it while we were on the bike, but kept it going. And I had a good race, yeah, against my old sparring partner, Chris Lieto there. He always seemed to bring the best out of me. And it was cold and wet, very cold and wet that year. And then the following year, it was the exact opposite. I think if the wind blows off the desert, it can be in the 90s or even triple figures Fahrenheit. And Chris was there again, and I just thought, I'm gonna bike with him this year. Whatever happens, I'm just going to bike with him. And I had a little lead on him out of the swim, and he caught me at mile 20, about 30K into it. And I biked with him the last 60K. And what I remember about the race was they didn't have the aid station set up, the back third of the bike course. So we were both rolling through as they were unloading the back of the trucks, trying to get the drinks set up. And I was as dry as you know what getting off the bike. I was that dehydrated. And I was with Chris. It was probably the only time in my career I got off the bike with him. And we had like a 4 minute lead or 5 minute lead over the next group. And I thought, I think he's going to get me today. As I was having these thoughts, we were running out of transition, which was set up down the main street. I thought, I think I'm cooked here. I'm in a lot of trouble. And just as I'm having that thought, Chris says, "You've got it, I'm done." And he sat down on the gutter. So I thought, I better keep going. He literally pulled out in T2. Oh. And then got out of transition. But it was a painful run. Benny Hoffman nearly ran me down. I think I held him off by a handful of seconds in the end. But a great race. I loved the 2 p.m. start. And as you were coming down the finish, it was like the equivalent of Pearl Street Mall, everyone out having dinner. There was a few bars, people were starting to get, always an awesome atmosphere. So yeah, good fun race.
I'm pretty sure I raced that year that you and Ben might have tussled it out. I think it was my first or second race in the US, but I raced it a year later, or maybe the year after, where it was so cold, Crowy, that they only allowed us to ride 20K down the hill. And then we got down to transition and I took like 12 minutes in transition because my hands wouldn't work to put my shoes on. And the guys that got first and second, Callum and Matty Reed, remember they had that sprint finish, but they'd actually ridden in their wetsuits for 20K and it saved their race.
I remember the famous photo of them crossing the line together. But yeah, they rode in their wetties. That was crazy.
I think it's interesting just, you know, these stories about big, not very big races being really important. And I think, do you have any races in mind that you, like outside of world champs and things that maybe you didn't win that stand out as a memory for you, Craig? Like, you know, some of my best races are races I didn't win. Like I think back to that kind of sprint finish we had in Geelong in 2015, or maybe it wasn't a sprint finish, but we ran together until 20K or so. That's, you know, a formative race for me and one that I look back to as one of my best races of all time.
And I think that was when Crowy just decided to go into zone three, wasn't it?
Crowy was coming off the back of a 40-hour training week. I was doing a 12-hour taper in fresh fruit. Yeah, do you have any races that stand out for you, Craig? Perhaps races that you didn't win, like outside of Kona and things. Obviously, they're the pinnacles of your career. But anything else?
Oh, mate, there were a lot of races, and by definition, thank you, Tim. A belated thank you for the nice intro. But as you guys all know, that as a pro athlete, you lose a lot more races than you win.
Yeah,
and that's just the way it is. So, and I think you learn something from all of them. Nothing that comes. I mean, I think my best ever performances actually was in a world championship, and I didn't win it. I finished second, 2012, 70.3 Worlds in Vegas. And the reason it was a good win, because I think it was the first. As you guys know, I was very fastidious and particular with my preparation. Attention to detail was a huge thing, like checking all the boxes. Of course, you've got to do all of the training you need to do. You've got to make sure your recovery is on point. I was very disciplined with my sleeping, making sure I was eating enough, strength and conditioning. Equipment wasn't as big a deal back then, but what we had available to us and what we knew, I made sure I was across all of that as much as possible. Most times I got to a start line, I felt that I prepared well. That doesn't guarantee anything really, other than it gave me confidence, you know, that I checked the boxes as much as I could. So, always lessen the anxiety for me in race week. But in 2012, very busy year. Of course, I'd won Kona and Vegas the year before. I didn't race much. We released the photo book that year, which was... looking back, I'm glad we did it because there's so many great photos of the kids in it, but it was such a stressful thing to meet the deadline to get it done. Neri fell pregnant with our third child towards the end of that year in Boulder. So we had a lot going on. And I remember it was about 10 days before Vegas Worlds. I had to get down to Denver for a sponsorship commitment. I'm trying to get, you know, 3 or 4 sessions done before lunchtime. So I think I'd gone out for an easy run. Then I went and did a swim, a master squat early, and then I was at the gym, and I wasn't even lifting actually. I was just moving a weight,
probably the problem with being a weak little triathlete. I just didn't square myself up to this bar well enough, and I hurt my back. And anyway, ended up going down to do the photo shoot, and I don't know if Dr. Garrett Rock still isn't around the tri scene in Boulder, but
I know Garrett.
So yeah. I went and saw Dr. Rock, and what ended up happening was I was supposed to get this medication, but I couldn't take it. It was on the banned substance list. It wasn't Garrett who had recommended it. It was another doctor. But what ended up happening was I put this anti-inflammatory cream on because I couldn't take the oral medication, and I had a skin reaction to it. And it was like I had a chemical burn, and I ended up at Boulder Hospital. And so the whole week before Vegas Worlds, I ended up driving out to Garrett's rooms in Louisville, and he would put me on this inverted bed to drain all the lymphatic fluid out of my, it was like I just had big swollen legs because all my skin blew up, and it was probably the first time leading into a big race. Things were way out of my control, and I just thought, I don't know if I should be racing in Vegas or not. Like Matt Steinmetz, who was helping me a lot there, he traveled out to the race with me, and I had to get off a lot of the medication, the antihistamine medication, like 4 days before the race, because it makes you drowsy. And I was so itchy, I couldn't sleep. I just wanted to rip my skin off. And you can ask Matt about this. He and I roomed together. I would sleep in.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
In the bathtub in the hotel room, naked, and he would just come in and pour ice into the bath. Sort of so I could get some relief from this skin. Nary didn't even want a room with me. Her and her sister they didn't even stay in our hotel. She's like, I'm not putting up with this. Exit stage left, I'm out of here. She had two young children to deal with. She didn't need a third.
It's small enough already without you lying in a bath with ice all over it.
Well, that's right. So, but yeah, I ended up going into that race so lacking confidence. But something in race week, I don't know, I'd read something and it said, you know what, the mark of a really mature and you know, mentally well-developed athlete is someone who can get a good result when things aren't going well. You know, it's never easy to get a good result, but when the ducks are all in a row and everything's going well, I mean, you're just doing your job. Who can do that when things are not going well? So I thought, okay, well, that's a test then, isn't it? Because usually things are going well and I'm just doing my job, what I'm supposed to be doing, and executing on race day. So I went into that race, and that was the famous race where Sebi Keenlay came out of the swim way back and came ripping past us on the bike, and we were getting splits that he was coming, and I had absolutely no power on the bike. I could hardly hold the aero position, and I was in the lead group with Bevan Doherty, Tim O'Donnell, Andy Potts. I think Terenzo was in there, Mikey Raylert, and you know, I was one of the favorites. I think they were expecting me to do a lot of work. I just couldn't. I wanted to, but I couldn't. And I had such good fitness going into that, but just couldn't demonstrate that fitness on the bike. But I hung in there, and I sucked the last 30K on the bike. I was terrible. I was nearly getting dropped. Seb had disappeared. But I actually got off the bike and had one of my best runs. I ended up with the silver medal, and that felt like a world championship win. So to answer your question, Sam, and I know it was a big race, but you know, in a race of that much visibility with that much pressure, I think it was the first time in a long time that I'd really been challenged mentally and physically. And I remember sitting in drug testing after the race, and Sebi was there with, well, it's now his wife, but she was saying, oh, did you know who Sebastian was? I'm like, yeah, I knew who he was. because he that was, I think it was the first time he'd come to the US to race him. But I've been following his career for 2 or 3 years, and I just, it's not like we let him go. We didn't really have a choice, and I certainly didn't have a choice. So I was, it was like sitting in that drug testing after the race, I felt like I'd won a gold medal. So, you know, and it's interesting when, because I'd won the race the year before, some of the interviews, people were like, are you disappointed? I was actually over the moon, because I thought that was a huge, even though it was at the back end of my career, you never stop learning and evolving as an athlete. And that gave me so much confidence that I wasn't just, you know, as they say in cricket, a flat track bully. I wasn't just a guy who could get things done when the going was good. Looks like we've lost Reedy.
Only... I'm still here. I don't know what happened then. Sorry.
Mate, you got to pay your power bills, mate.
I'm still listening. I've just heard this story 8 times, Crowey, that's all.
He didn't want to look rude when he was nodding off to sleep.
No offense
taken, in case you were wondering.
Yeah. I love that, Crowey, though, because I think for all of us, I know for myself, there's races where, you know, I wasn't even on the podium, but there's plenty of races where I'm almost ashamed that I gave up. And there's races where I know, you know, one race you were involved with, I got a flat tire and really put myself back in a position to win the race. I think we were at Racine or somewhere like that. Another race in Thailand, same thing, 8 to 10 minutes. But those races where you just like, it is what it is, I'm not going to give up. I look back at those so proud. And there's other races even where I've won and I'm like, I was a bit mentally weak that day, you know, like I could have done better. So it's
the interesting dynamic as a pro athlete, because now I work with a lot of younger athletes and, you know, I coach in the local surf club and a few things. And, you know, it's one thing I always used to hear as a kid, you just got to do your best. And you think that's so simple. That's simple advice. You've just got to do your best in any given situation. Then the world gets more complicated as you get older, you get more complicated, but does it really? I mean, that is such good advice, you know? Yeah. I mean, just to give the best you've got in any given moment. And I guess another one, Apo, to your question was Kona that year. I wasn't going to race. My back didn't come good, but I had such good fitness. And again, I was the defending champ and I could hardly hold the time trial position, but I got up to Harvey in like third or fourth spot and then couldn't stay down on the bars pretty much the whole way back into town. Ended up coming off the bike way back, and first time I'd ever gone over 3 hours for the marathon, first time I'd ever walked in a marathon. And, you know, after the race, people saying, oh, it must have been embarrassing, or it must have been, and it kind of wasn't. I'm so proud of that race. It was the first time my brother had flown over to watch me race in Hawaii, and it was actually easy to push and to give everything, because I think, again, when things are going well,
it's easy when things are going well, isn't it? It's when training's going well, it's easy. It's easy to get out the door and train hard and everything's coming easily. It's hard when it's not going your way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? It's some great advice I got from one of my first ever swim coaches. He was just old school. He's an ex-Olympic gold medalist. And he used to say, just don't quit before the magic happens. Hang in there. He said, every big breakthrough I had in my career came shortly after I felt like I was plateauing or even going backwards, and I was so frustrated I just wanted to walk away. And, you know, I'm just always glad that I just hung in there and gave it one more mile or one more lap or whatever. So I think, again, it's the importance of having good people around you and getting that sort of advice. Yes, in a world with so much sensory input these days, every now and again something just filters through, gets through your thick skull and sinks in there, and it leaves a lasting impact.
One of the races that you didn't win, but I look back on, and you probably do as well, Crowey, that was a really, really impressive performance, was that first time in Hawaii. Like, historically, that no one really goes there and has a good day, and that seemed to be a very, very good day.
Mate, it was a great day. And look, it's hard. I mean, as you guys know, we didn't track as much data back then as we do now. And we're so keen to always compare performances. As coaches, that's why we normalize power now, so we can make a valid comparison between a flat course and a hilly course. How does that performance stack up against that one? And I want to say it was one of the fittest. It was certainly the top two times I turned up on the Big Island with the fitness I had. But again, it just shows the importance of you know, the mind-body connection, and the mind's in charge. I mean, I'd had an unbelievable season that year. I think leading up to that point, I'd done 11 races and won 7 of them across all distances. I mean, one of my last races was the Lifetime Fitness race against Greg Bennett and Simon Whitfield and all those. And I got third. You know, I was already in my Ironman build, and I got third in an Olympic distance race. I'd won a bunch of halves. I had a lot of confidence. And, you know, I'd never done it. Or I'd done Port Macquarie earlier that year, but I'd done that off. At that point in my career, all my sponsorships were set up around the US. And, you know, my big early season target was always the St. Anthony St. Croix double. So that's what I was training for. I'd already qualified for Kona by winning the 70.3 Worlds the year before. But I thought, you know, it would be nice to do Port Macquarie. You know, my parents could watch, my family could be there. But I was actually training for St. Anthony's, an Olympic distance race. But I went up and did Port anyway, and I'm so glad I did, because I think the things that happened in that race helped me for Kona later that year. You know, I'd done a 2-hour long run in the lead up, because even for Olympic distance racing, you still do a, you know, a 2-hour long run or an hour 40 long run. I was riding 4 hours regularly because I always did that even when I was racing Olympic distance. But I just worked out what the back third of the bike feels like, and what the second half of a marathon feels like when you haven't prepared properly. So, you know, there was lessons there, but I was super fit, because I went over, I got third in Port, and then went over and got third in St. Anthony's 2 weeks later, and won St. Croix. I won St. Croix by 5 minutes, and it was a stacked field. So it gave me a lot of confidence that even though I'm very new to Ironman racing, I mean, a lot of the guys I beat in St. Croix that year were some of the guys I were talking about as being favorites for Kona. And, you know, I remember there was a guy there, part of the organizers, Tom Zebart, who you guys might know. He's at a lot of the Ironman races in North America. He said to me after the race in St. Croix, man, people who race well, he normally race well in Kona, even though it's half the distance, because it's hot and it's hilly and it's windy. So I thought, well, you know, I think Farris was in the race, Macca was in that race. I'd won the race by 5 minutes. And I thought, okay, well, I'm not a naturally super confident / arrogant guy thinking I can just walk into Hawaii, but surely if these are the guys who are being talked about as the favorites, I'm in the ballpark somewhere if I can tidy up those areas that I need to tidy up after Port Macquarie. So trained very hard, just had everything seemed to fall into place. I just had a great summer up in Boulder. You know, I was working with a good coach called Nick White out of Arizona, who was, I think, my age or even younger than me, but man, he was just such an amazing guy. You know, I mean, you guys coach, you know, in any good coaching relationship, it's like a collaboration, especially with an experienced athlete. The flow of information goes both ways in a good relationship. And he was just so open to different ideas, but he also tabled a few ideas. I'm like, damn, I never even thought of doing that. It's a great idea. He got me doing double threshold days and threshold back to back and a lot of things that I'd never done. I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, I was always so mindful of recovery up at altitude, but I'd been up there for 2 or 3 years by then. He just put a few different ideas on my radar. And anyway, we go in to Kona, and I just had a really good build up. I wrote my own training plan, and I wasn't sure what to do, even though I was working with Nick. He oversaw everything. And, you know, it's funny because I wrote this 5 week, what I called my push phase. And I had no idea if I was doing the right things, but I'd spoken to Welshie, I'd spoken to McKeely, kind of knew Peter Reed. I'd run into Samantha McGlone at a sponsorship commitment, and she was traveling a similar path to me. She'd won 70.3 Worlds the year before, and she was stepping up to do an Ironman. And she was good friends with Peter Reed and a few of the Canadians, so she'd got a lot of intel from them, and we compared what we're doing. So, you know, there's a lot of similarities there. But anyway, I'd come off. It was mid-late July. I think I'd just done that lifetime race, actually, where I'd finished third. Yeah, because that was always mid-July. Had an easier week, and then I was starting my push into Kona, and I was over at Craig Walton's house. He was having a barbecue. Nery and I were over there. I only had one kid at that point, Lucy. Lucy was there running amok, probably tearing the place apart. But I remember while I was at the back cooking the barbie, and I was out there with him, you know, we're having a beer, and he had this coffee table. He had this book on. I think it was called The Law of Running. I can't remember. It was a thick book, and I picked it up and started flicking through, and Mark Allen had a chapter in the book, and I was flicking through, and then Mark had literally detailed what he called his push phase in the build up to Kona. And it was eerily almost identical to what I'd done, like the structure, the volume, everything, the intensities in there. I'm like, so that was the first thing. I thought, okay, well, I'm sort of, and I just, Nick and I had bounced a few ideas off, and then I used a bit of intuition and my background experience. So I come up with this plan. So that was the first thing. I'm like, okay, I think I'm on the right track here. At least I've got the volumes and the right mix, I think. And then another thing happened. I went out to dinner with my manager at the time, Franco, and Dr. Alan Lim was there at dinner. And I ended up sat next to Alan, and we were chatting away. He said a few things to me about strength training and other things. And it was just really good advice. And some of it I'd already incorporated. So it just gave me a lot of confidence. You know, when things sort of fall into place like that, I think it shows how important the mind is. So I had a lot of momentum, did a great like lead up. But what happened was I got to Kona and started running into friends, mentors, people I look up to. And almost from the minute we landed, like the first thing that happened was I was down the street. I might've been having a swim at the pier. And I ran into Paula Newby-Fraser, who I knew quite well, always a great mate. Always gave me advice unsolicited, but I loved it. And, she hadn't seen me for a long time, and she looked at me and she's like, oh my gosh, you've lost so much weight. This is a strength course. This is a strongman's race. Look, you're too lean. And she didn't mean anything by it, but that was the first sort of seed of doubt that got planted in race week. So now I'm like, really? I didn't even think about my weight as impacting my performance. I just felt that if I'm strong in training, that's all that mattered. And I had been. So that was the first seed of doubt. And then a couple of days later, ran into Welshie, who was the reason I got into the sport. I love Greg. He's one of my best friends still to this day. And we're having a coffee and a chat. And he said, look, mate, this is a different race. This is a different beast. Everyone, you know, it took Mark 7 times to win here. You know, it took me 7 times. Chris has raced here 6 times. He still hasn't won here. You know, it's just one of those races.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
So I guess my confidence got eroded during race week, and I didn't have expectations that I was going to win the race, but I had complete expectations that I was in the mix somewhere and we'll just see what happens. We'll play the cards where they lay. That's a different mindset. You know, that's almost an attackive, not aggressive mindset, but I'm ready for this. I'm up for this. I'm good to go to, geez, I need to be more defensive here. Maybe I have to do an apprenticeship. Maybe this race is a little different. Am I too light? That's Paula said I was too light. And these are people who I had a great relationship, who I knew loved me and had nothing but my best interests at heart. And they're almost throwaway lines to them. But, you know, to me, it was like, oh, maybe I have underestimated this challenge. And so to your point, Clint, that was a great performance. But, you know, I'll tell you a story. I crossed the finish line and I also hurt, I re-injured my back 10 days leading into that race, which I've never really talked about. Well, not a lot, but I reached in to Lucy's cot to pick her up and did the same. It was an injury I'd battled with my whole career, really, a back thing that I got pre-career when I used to labor for a builder. I hurt my back and also got a hernia when I was 17, 18 years of age. And by doing a lot of core work and strength and conditioning, I kept it under control, but it flared up every now and again. And anyway, I heard it 10 days before the race in Kona. We were staying out at Waikoloa. But Lisa Bentley, who was a good friend of mine, she had a therapist there, and he was like the therapist for the Toronto Maple Leafs NHL. Mate, he was a guru, this guy. And he said, no, man, you'll be able to race. You'll be good. No dramas. And he patched me up. So that was the first thing. That was another little thing that eroded my confidence a little bit. So I went into the race just almost with, I think, a defensive mindset. You know, I'm not here to win. Maybe a top five or a top eight would be an amazing result. So as we got the crazy thing was, again, something I haven't talked about much, but the majority of the top 10 from the year before got sick. You know, the Wednesday of race week, I turned up to have a swim at the pier and it had rained overnight a lot. And I bumped into a friend of mine. He's like, what are you doing, man? Nobody swims here after it rains because the stormwater runoff goes straight into the bay. I was like, really? He's like, why do you think there's not a lot of people here? He said, go and have a swim at the pool. So I did. But a lot of experienced athletes had a swim. Norman got in and had a swim. Farris got in and had a swim. Ruud Gebieke, who got third, had a swim. Brownie had a swim. And then sure enough, 48 hours later, they were all sick. And, you know, I'll never forget race morning. Farris pulled out while we're in transition before the race. Brownie pulled out. Beaky didn't even turn up. Ruud Gebieke, he was out. Norman was sick. He was throwing up. He caught us 40, 50K into the bike, vomiting on the bike. He pulled out at Waikala on the way out of town. So I don't want to say it was a soft year, but, you know, when half the top 10 from the year before are not there, I mean, if you look at historically, if you look at the stats, the top 10 from the year before, a large majority of those athletes, you know, fill the top 10. So,
bro, we can delete all this bit. You don't need to make excuses for a second place.
Yeah, come on now. No,
it's not. Wait till I tell you about 2016 world champs in Sunny Coast.
But hey. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that I'm waffling on a bit is just how you can be in the best physical shape possible, but if your mental game's not on point, your mental development and progression needs to keep pace with your physical development and your physical fitness. And yeah, I just raced defensively. All the contenders pulled out on the morning of, or a lot of them, some pulled out during the race. I think I hopped off the bike and I was in the top five off the bike. I think Simbali was up the road. And maybe Torbjorn was up the road. Who else that year?
Leota.
I don't think he. I think he was with us. I think he caught us. Might have been Marino. There were two or three up the road. Anyway, I still had this mindset. Top eight would be acceptable. And mate, before I knew it, I hadn't even got off a lead driving. I was in second spot. Or I think actually by the time we got up onto the highway, Macca was in the lead and I was in second. And Tim DeBoom actually was. He'd been sick. I remember him running on a lead drive, vomiting as well. So I think he'd maybe got sick as well. So, but I don't know. I kind of subconsciously maybe felt the job's done here. But I'll never forget seeing my best mate who was out on the Queen K that day. And he's an ex-pro footballer. When we met, we're at uni. He's playing in the NRL. And so he didn't have a triathlon background or an endurance sports background, but he was a competitor and a pro, you know, a pro athlete himself. And I remember coming out of the energy lab, I think I was about 90 seconds behind, and I saw him. He was out there on a bike and I was looking back over my shoulder. I'm like, you know, pointing to my watch, what's the split? What's the split? And I was asking for the split back to third. And he's like, forget third, mate. Like the race is up the road. So I think it's, and after the race, he said to me, like, where was your head at? Like you could see, like I'm saying, what's the split? And he's like, well, you can see him. And I'm like, no, back here. And he's like, man, that's completely the wrong mindset to have. Like you've got 12 or 13 K left to run. So, and I finished the race that year. I think I ran a 2:44. Chris had an unbelievable race. Let's not sugarcoat it. He ran a 2:41 or a 2:42. His best run there ever. Tactically, he was amazing all day. But when we got to the finish, he was sort of, he looked like someone who'd run a 2:41 and gone deep. And Neri came up to me and said, oh, how do you feel? I said, I feel good. And she said, well, you know, in the way she always used to say, she said, well, you know, maybe next year you want to look a little bit more like that than how you look.
Yeah. Crowe, while we're on the Kona in particular, with the faster times that we're seeing, what's your take on how much of it is there a performance gain or depth increase amongst the field, and how much is it, you know, equipment? Because, you know, what I've, you know, Clint and I froth on shoe testing for everyone. We froth on aerodynamics of the new equipment. I know what shoes you were running in. You were in ASICS that year, I think, before you signed with Newton.
I was in ASICS in 06. I was Newton 07.
Yeah, and like probably one of their race flats or something.
Yeah.
But literally probably 15 seconds per case slower than what we're in now. You can start on that because I'll listen back to it. I've got to go grab a cord, but please keep going.
Mate, you told me this was a pro setup and a pro operation. What's going on here? No, it's a good question. I mean, I'll just start by saying I have a theory. I actually think that every generation does get a little better than the previous generation. I think that's just the way sports evolve and develop. And I think as fans of the sport and as athletes within the sport, that's what you would expect. And that's what you would hope. You would hope that things progress. And every generation has its transcendent performers and transcendent performances. But yeah, I just feel that, I don't think there's any doubt there's more depth. There's more depth. And you might counter that by saying, well, there's also more races, so that depth gets spread. I remember when I stepped up, or when 70.3 became a thing in 06, you really only had six or seven races in the series. So at every race, you'd have Andy Potts, you'd have Terenza, you'd have Raylert. But then as the years passed and more races got added, the depth got spread. I feel now, and even more so with the Ironman Pro Series and the T100 the last few years, I feel the depth is greater than it's ever been. So, and I think that contributes, you know, when it's competitive racing, that brings the best out of athletes. So yeah, I've got a theory that every generation gets a little better because I think the coaches get better. I think a lot of the knowledge is the same, but there's innovations and then the knowledge evolves and the way we apply that knowledge gets better. So I think we know more about recovery, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things when I go out to Kona, the gun goes off 40 minutes earlier now. So that has an impact. You know, that's 40 minutes further down the Queen K before the wind gets up and the heat gets up. I think that's important. You know, the road's pot mixed now. It's beautiful surface the whole time. The shoes, the super shoes, I think, you know, I look at the bikes now and I think certainly the first 4 years I raced in Kona, I didn't have an aero helmet. I had a road helmet because the aero helmets were not, they were clunky. They were not as ventilated, you know, race suits weren't fitted, all of those things. But yeah, I mean, I think I look at the bikes and look at people running, you know, 28 and 30 mil tires with the pressures they're running now and the aerodynamics of a tire and wheel setup. I look at those front end cockpits. That's the thing in bikes I'm most envious of because I, you know, with that back thing that I talked about, I mean, if you look at some of the aero bars I ran in Kona, in 08 and 09, like the where you rested your elbow actually on the aero bar was like a postage stamp. It was so small. So you actually needed to use your core to cantilever your body and hold it there the whole ride. I think those new bars, you can
You're firing Reedy up now, mate.
Oh, no, I totally agree, Crowe. I think the new positions and the way you can basically have a fairing on your bike, like it is so comfortable. I'd rather be in that position than out on my road bike.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Whereas I remember just how uncomfortable the TT position was.
Mate, I remember you. Yeah. You were always ahead of your time with aerodynamics. You trying to put tape and close the gap and the technical officials came and took it off in transition. Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I've had a few run-ins with officials over the years because it's like there are a set of rules, but it's so sporadic as to when they're applied. There's no consistency. So you see what you get away with. With aerodynamics.
Before we move on from that kind of performance, Crow, you just got it. Like first year in Hawaii, not a skerrick of carbon in your shoes and running a 244. You can play it down as much as you want, mate. That's amazing.
It's a 230. It's a 239, 238 every day of the week now. Yeah. And I would say, looking at what your equipment was on the bike back then, I mean, you're looking at, it's easy 80 to 100 watts. For the same speed, so you're probably riding, you know, 30 minutes quicker.
That was that era where, like, if you look back on the photos, some at like Andy Potts, for example, he would look at his photos now and just go, Wow, I was giving away like way too much power.
He's the one that probably should have a Kona title to his name because of equipment.
Man, he was an awesome athlete. I mean, nearly made the Olympics for swimming in you know, the late 90s, 2000 Sydney Olympics. I mean, he was that level. Finished on the podium at the US Olympic trials swimming. I think he had a 416, 400 IM to his credit. Swam at Michigan in college. I mean, yeah. And a great runner his whole life as well. You know, through high school and college, he used to run cross country. He was a phenomenal athlete. But I think the thing is, back then, we sort of knew, but there wasn't the infrastructure and I guess the technology around a lot of the manufacturing. Like, we knew that tri-spokes were quicker and that bikes without beams, like TJ's Diamond bike. Now, we knew they were quicker, but you just couldn't build them because that pivot point where the beam would attach to the down tube would always break. Carbon technology is not what it is now. So I think there was always this dream that we would hear about, this idea of, you know, these mystical watts that we could save somehow. But it just took a while for carbon technology to catch up. And I mean, I looked at Patrick last year. And Reedy, you and I were at a race that I think Patrick announced himself in Subic Bay in 2016. Mm. 3 weeks or 4 weeks after that race, he won Ironman Texas. And then later that year, he got third in Kona. And I'd heard of Patrick because he was a physio and I'm a physio. And we were both running in Newton shoes at the time. And I had a good friend who lived in Mallorca, which is where he was based and training. But I had a chat to Patrick last year. I mean, he did that phenomenal time in Kona, which when you were there live, I mean, it felt like it was good conditions. But I don't care. It's still Kona and it's hot. And some of those times I'm just thinking, this is out of this world. But I mean, Patrick was telling me that, you know, he broke his Kona PB on the bike by 16 minutes that year. He'd ridden a 422 2 years before when the men raced. He rode a 406 last year. You guys know it at the highest level when you sort of have been training your aerobic engine for years and you've maximized training practices and you get to that point where you almost do hit a physiological ceiling, you know, and to take 16 minutes off a bike time, some of it is condition dependent, but that's a huge chunk of time to take off. I put it down to the bike tech and also nutrition. I think nutrition, people can fuel their, I mean, one of the things I've noticed commentating these races this year is that a lot of the splits athletes are laying down for men and women in the first half of the bike and the first half of the run. They're actually getting closer to that utopia of an even split than we ever did. Like, I was always way off. And part of that was in Kona on the bike. I would consciously slow down the last 60K because I trained out there. I did two training stints out there and just worked out for me to run a 240 marathon here, I have to back off the last hour 20 on the bike a little bit, not a lot, just enough. And, but I just look at the athletes, the modern day athletes and just their performances across the longer distance, even middle distance is better. They're just, and who knows why? I mean, it's fun to talk about. I have a theory that every generation is just getting a little better, but it's interesting as, I mean, we all geek out on the tech and we love, but some of the times you do see now, you just sit back and raise your eyebrows and go, wow, that was just 20 years ago. It was thought impossible, really.
Yeah. I think too, that a lot of the, especially on the run, probably guys, it seems to help.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Guys that wouldn't run that quick a lot more than it helps natural runners. You know, exactly like a wetsuit. I don't think Apo's ever run quicker with the super shoot era. I know I didn't. Lionel hasn't. These guys that were running really quick before, But then you're seeing guys, a lot of the 115, 116, 118 sort of runners are all running 111s, 112s. And I think especially big, tall guys, it just really, it can really help them just get that big bound out of their leg stride.
Yeah, well, I think one of the, like, I think there's a few advantages to the super shoes. Obviously, the obvious one on race day is the carbon plate, how it, and you can feel it, as you guys know, when, I mean, I can feel it within a 400 when you start to lose that muscle elasticity and stiffness, that carbon plate just stores the energy through stance phase and then releases it at toe off. It just keeps pitching you forward. And that's good running, being in the air more than you're on the ground, and that, you know, forward momentum more than up and down. But I also think just the new foam and the thicker stack height could lead to better recovery, maybe an extra two runs a week over the course of a build-up. I mean, what does that mean for your aerobic fitness and just your longevity and your recovery? So, yeah, there's a lot of advantages. I mean, we all laughed at some of these shoe brands when they came out with these crazy stack heights. And but it wasn't just the stack height. It was just the new, the foam and the characteristics of that new foam. And then, you know, adding the carbon plate as well. It was the one discipline I thought perhaps we wouldn't see technology. I don't want to say tamper with the purity of it, but you know, swimming you could understand because water is such a thick, dense medium that something that improves your hydrodynamics like a skin suit or a wetsuit, your buoyancy is going to make a big difference. Of course, the bike, anything that lowers your coefficient of drag or your coefficient of friction is going to be huge over that length of time. But I just thought with running, we wouldn't.
Sorry, before we go to the next topic, Crowe, I'm just curious as to why Clint keeps moving his trophy in and out of the screen. You have a trophy it's next. Oh,
is that? I moved it once because I saw it and I thought that was a bit. But
put it back, mate. We're not. Trophy is a Clint.
It's not actually my trophy. Yeah, it is.
here we've got Apo's just coming up on his 20th 70.3 win, and we actually Apo and I were talking about that the other day, thinking this is bloody good. And then I was looking through Crowe's results, and I was like, oh, I've totally forgot. Crowe got 20 70.3 wins in a row. Apo, not even over a 15-year career.
That's
over so 4 years.
That was shitty. I thought it was the RPG one from Port Reed, but it is one of mine from way back then. And it's that's so bad.
That looks like
it's actually
third place in your age group at
No, it was age group at
Byron Bay. Yeah, Byron Bay try, yeah. Third place.
It's actually there to hold my blind still so it doesn't move at all.
But oh, anyway, I thought you were like, hang on, I'm going to bring this in the picture. Oh, this was one of my best days.
I know my place in this this conversation, mate.
Be loud and proud, mate. Be loud and proud.
Let's move on from results and a little bit of triathlon. One of the things that we did want to talk about, Crowe, equal pay in sport. I don't know how much you follow other sports, but the WNBA players at the moment are, I guess we can say, blowing up about the lack of money they get, and they want to be paid close to equally, although the WNBA is losing money. Probably a bit of a touchy subject, but...
I want to hear Apo's and your opinion too, Clint, if that's all right.
Oh, I wanted to throw Crowe under the bus first.
Definitely.
And then we might try and save him. So thoughts on...
You're trying to get us cancelled. We're going to get cancelled.
Thoughts on being paid close to equal, Crowe, when the league doesn't necessarily make enough?
I'll happily dive under the bus. firstly, I just want to say that trophy you held up, not wanting to digress, it looked like a stencil that you'd spray paint an M-dot on the road. It looked like it's a course marker that they've turned into a trophy.
That's
Ironman cutting corners.
I do that all around the house just to remind Emma that I used to, you know, win my age group at races, you know.
No. You know, sorry to go in on this between Emma and Clint. Out of all our partners, no one treated their partner like such a pro athlete like Emma treats Clint. Mate, when he was in training, it was like...
didn't have kids.
I remember meeting Emma and Clint in Xiamen. It was in China. It was in Xiamen. mate, that was 11 years ago. And
stop it.
Yeah, you were saying, Emma, quick, go grab me a coffee. The race is starting in an hour. Emma, Greg, I need some sun cream. rubbed down my back. Emma, can you get to the hotel? I've left my elastic laces.
Yeah.
This is a great stitch up.
I'm like, who's this guy? I'm looking at scanning. Yeah. I was doing commentary that day. I'm like scanning the pro list and thinking, this is a pro athlete I've missed.
You know where this ended up? This ended up with Crowey abusing the medical staff for me because I was in medical because I couldn't breathe from the air quality over there. So I do
Emma,
owe you a thanks.
Emma
for
forgot
that.
Your Ventolin. What was going on?
That race was actually you and Emma Pallant. Remember Emma Pallant was in there as well?
It was concerning. But mate, it was concerning. Just before we move on from this, I will go. I don't know where we're staying, not letting go, Reedy, but it was lunchtime and Emma said, oh, do you want a sandwich? And Reedy looked at me like he was just in shock. And he goes, I don't think Monica's ever offered to make me a sandwich. And every time now Emma says something about lunch or something, I'm like, I'll get my own sandwich. All right. I'll get my own. But anyway, back to the WNBA and throwing Crowey under the bus. Thoughts on equal pay, mate?
Yeah, it's a good question because I sit on both sides of that fence. I have two daughters. And I do believe that if we want young, talented female athletes to get into sport, there's an aspirational element that pro sports provide. And it's relatable for young female athletes to see older female athletes, more relatable than seeing guys. You see it with the Matildas in soccer, our female national soccer team and the explosion in women's soccer in Australia. And globally, really. I mean, I remember visiting when my oldest was trying to get a running scholarship to college. We visited a few schools and we're at UNC, University of North Carolina, one day for a visit to meet the track coach. And there was a women's junior soccer camp on and they had 10,000 girls, 5 or 10,000. I can't remember. It was a lot, mate. It was unbelievable. They had like 10 synthetic fields set up, games going on everywhere. And so I don't think we can ever understate the importance that these young athletes have role models, older role models they can look up to. I guess I do. I'm emotionally invested too. I mean, back here in Australia where I take my son to the gym, a lot of the NRLW girls train there. And I watch these girls train, man, and they're athletes. The weight training, the grappling, the cardio they're doing, you know, and there's NRL guys there doing the same training, but the NRLW girls then shower and go off to work. So, but the business side of it is it does come down to supply and demand. I mean, a lot of money comes into sports through sponsorship, corporate partners, and TV money. So, and the TV money comes from viewership, what people want to watch. So ultimately, I guess that's what, for these big, and I haven't looked under the hood of the WNBA in terms of what their viewership numbers are. If you say they're losing money, I mean, I think a lot of sports are losing money because it's just a different landscape now too. There's so many different platforms to watch sports on. Like, it's even within our sport, you know, if you want to watch races, sometimes you don't hear that they're on, or you hear after the fact and you think, well, how do I watch that? It's complicated to watch. Do I need a subscription to this, or do I have to sign on to that? The bigger sports don't have those issues though, like the WNBA. I mean, I think it's easy to watch. But I mean, I'm not an expert in the WNBA, but I followed a little bit because of Caitlin Clark. So, I mean, I've watched over here from afar, and I've, having lived in the US for you know, 4 to 6 months of the year for 15 or 20 years, I used to love the sport over there, the pro sport and college sports. So, but in the end, what keeps sports afloat is money. So, I mean, let's look at the Olympics as another example. You guys will all remember because, you know, I'm the oldest on this podcast, but, you know, coming through when triathlon got in the Olympics, for instance, there was talk it was going to be a demonstration sport. Will it be a full medal sport? Would it stay? If you wanted to go through that program, it was very political. You know, the talk was always going to be that, you know, you didn't need your own sponsors because the governing body of the sport would get such huge global sponsorship that the prize money would be exponentially greater. None of that ever happened. And in fact, now you look at the Olympics and the IOC themselves are leaning on sports that are traditionally not Olympic sports to prop up the Olympic movement. Golf is in there. Tennis is in there. Surfing is in there. All these sports that ran themselves as businesses are in there.
Esports as well, video games and stuff. It's not in the Olympics, but they're looking at it because it's such a huge market.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's, so you put in a sport that people want to watch, people tune in to watch. Whoever the governing body is can sell the TV rights for a lot more because then they can on-sell the advertising for a lot more. So I'm no expert in this, but there's a lot of wheels in play. But, I mean, I also look at tennis. I mean, we talk about WNBA. I look at tennis and, you know, I've gone to the Australian Open a couple of times. And to be honest, you know, there's always that argument, well, the men play five, the women only play three. I've watched a couple of women's matches that have been as entertaining or more entertaining, I think, because they do only have three sets, so they unload early. Like sometimes you'll be watching a men's tennis match, and I mean, I used to see it all the time. Some of the big four would lose a set or two, and then it'd go to five sets, and they'd really, you know, they'd lift their level. But in the women, they come, you know, straight out of the gates. They come out quick. So the entertainment packed into three sets. I mean, how do you quantitatively or objectively measure the entertainment value across three sets as opposed to five? I don't know the answer, but I, you know, I remember a long, long time ago at the Noosa Triathlon, there was a huge argument for equal pay, and the organizers did it. And we're a sport that I think has always been ahead of the game with that. We've had people like Aaron Baker, Jackie Gallagher pushing for it. You know, at Noosa this one year, there was equal pay. And I remember there was like 112 men on the start line and it paid top 10. And I think there were 10 or 11 girls on the start line and it paid top 10. And I remember having a conversation with Jackie. You know, RIP Jackie, she was one of the trailblazers in our sport after that. And I remember her saying, or actually me saying to her, well, actually, the script got flipped because it ended up being better pay for women in this race than men. And she said, you know, Crowe, honestly, like, this is the first time we've done it, or one of the first times. Let's give it a chance. And I thought, you know what, that's just like with the NRLW girls or the WNBA. Money will run out at some point. And the people, you know, behind the scenes at the WNBA, they're not listening to us on this podcast in terms of how they do business. maybe they are. Maybe they are. But I kind of think that we've got to give the girls a chance to train the same way the boys do and see what level they can bring. And then let's, like we're in this world, we're so quick to judge everything. Like in any sport, state of origin, whatever, you know, selections are made and everyone's criticizing. It's like, well, hang on, let's wait for the game.
I think there's a responsibility from the men's organizations, even if it is a separate company or separate entity, that, you know, let's say the NBA should be helped to fund the WNBA if it's running at a loss, because it's a long-term play, like you said. And I think people start to appreciate the sport the more exposure you get to it and the more stars come out like Caitlin Clark. And I think, you know, it's terrible that you've got professional athletes trying to train like a pro and then having to go off to work. And I just think, yeah, I understand. I think it's always hard if an employee is asking for a pay rise when the employer's clearly doesn't have the money, or it's just not viable to keep the business going long term. But that's where I think it's a responsibility of the male organizations, which, especially if they are very profitable, they need to be chipping in, I think, is just the right thing to do.
That happens in college sports, Title IX. That happens in college sports over in the US. And to Jackie's point, it's not a quick fix. Like, you look at Caitlin Clark, for example. Yeah, she was probably one of that generation who was 6 or 7 years old when the WNBA first came about. So she's the first generation who've grown up watching women, practiced the same way boys her age would, and look at the level she's got. So let's give it another generation.
It's definitely the same with, and you saying NRLW, Crowley, like 5 years ago, you'd watch the game and it was like considerably slower and it was a bit clunky. And even now, while they're still working full time, a lot of them, the level that they've got to, just with that little bit more support. And I can speak to it a bit with Kate coming from AFLW. She played in the first few seasons of AFLW where, full time job, training just like your park footy players. And now they're all, it's steadily coming up where they're, the level that they're getting to with the support they're they're getting to a lot higher level than the support that they're getting. So if it's just propped up for just that, even one generation, I think it'll be really a package, whether it be NRLW or the WNBA or AFLW, where young girls aspire to go and that's the path they want to take.
Yeah, mate, I agree. I think it's, there's no right or wrong answer, because Reedy's right. If you're a corporation or, you know, an enterprise, and to be financially viable, you can't spend money you don't have. So, but hopefully, maybe we're all wearing rose-colored glasses, but another entity like the NBA come in and think, well, we're going to contribute to the long-term growth and health of the sport across both genders. And yeah, who knows what wealthy people in boardrooms, what decisions they make. But yeah, as a dad with two daughters, I'd hate to think that my daughters don't have the same opportunities that my son would have. I mean, I think it's ridiculous. And we can't expect, you know, the same quality of performance if we don't allow the same time and quality of preparation. It's just, it's ridiculous to judge the girls based on, you know, the limited preparation they've had and compare that to the men's product. It just, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Broey, when speaking of that, seeing it's, there is a couple of answers to that. I remember years ago, I'm not sure if it was in Boulder or if it was in Australia, but Neri once said to me, Craig's always black and white on things, you know, there's no middle ground. As you've gotten older, I know, like, I used to be very black and white on things. And as I've gotten older, I've started to, I think I'm changing a little bit to, I guess I'm still black and white on some things, but I'm more open to different ideas and sometimes realizing that there's a few different answers to, or different perspectives around different issues. Have you found as you've gotten older, you are getting a bit less black and white, or is it still, that's still a very Crowy trait?
I mean, I think as we get older, hopefully more mature, more knowledgeable, you can see things from a different perspective. And it's crazy, you know, because I played team sports until I was 20. So I was used to being in a locker room or in a team with different personalities. But I don't think you frame it the same way. And in those formative years in my early 20s, just as an individual athlete, yeah, I just thought everyone thought like me. And, you know, which is crazy again, because I studied as a physio, and a big part of that is behavioral science, how we're just all different. For better or worse, we are who we are. And you plonk each of us down in a given situation, and we're going to interpret the input differently. But, you know, I think so. I think a few important things, milestones happen in your life. One of them is you become a parent, hopefully. Not for everyone, but... And it's crazy, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, all of us in this room, you know, you go through your 20s and you're focused, you're dedicated, you're trying to get ahead in life. And then all of a sudden, from the first second that you become a parent for the first time, something dawns on you, this idea that you actually are responsible for somebody else, and not just you. You and your partner are responsible for this person, and then you're responsible, you and your partner are responsible for each other. So you've already dipped your toe in that realm of thinking that it's not just you against the world, you're with somebody else. But then this baby comes along and you're like, okay, I'm responsible for this child. And I think it just, I am black and white on a lot of things still, I think, in and around certain things in life. But as it relates to the human condition, man, we're all different. You know, I remember one time in Boulder, being at Rally Pool, this was years ago, more than a decade ago, and did the swim squad, and then I was in the baby pool with Lucy and Austin, and Tim DeBoom and Nicole were there with their daughter. And I was having a chat to Tim, he'd retired, and he said to me, oh yeah, I just think I'm a better person now. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, no, I think I'm a better person. I'm like, no, you're the same person. But what a stupid thing for me to say. We're never the same person day after day, year after year, because we're influenced by our environment.
Yeah, yeah.
All of these things, all these different inputs. I mean, there's a huge genetic traits and predispositions as well, but of course we're influenced by our environment. And I said, well, what do you mean you're a better person? So I'm less distracted.
I can engage more with the world around me and the people around me, and I've got these things going on. And I thought, oh, and it was something that never really dawned on me. And then, you know, a lot long ago, I caught up with a mate and we're chatting away, and he sort of just said, oh man, I always love catching up with you. You're far less distracted than when you're an athlete. I'm like, what do you mean by that? But I sort of knew what he meant. Like, for a start, I'm catching up with people more often. You know, I think when you guys know what it's like, you're chasing something that's hard. I didn't have the bandwidth to be good at sport and a good socializer and good at everything. And particularly because I always felt I was behind the eight ball. I was late to the sport, you know, from soccer. And then I was late to Ironman. I didn't do my first Ironman until I was 33 or 34. So I was late to that. I always felt like, man, it's going to take everything I have just to be competitive here. I haven't got the bandwidth or the capacity to be catching up with people regularly and being, you know, answering all my emails all of the time. I just have to rev in the red the whole time, all year. Otherwise, I'm not going to get to where I want to go. So, yeah, no, I think I'm less black and white. I know I am. I see it in situations all the time. And especially since my children are all, they're 20, 16 and 12 now. So, and you guys will get to this point too soon enough. You're probably getting that close there, really. Well, you're already seeing their personalities. But then they come home and, you know, I remember the first time my Lucy came home and she said, I said, how was your day at school, sweetheart? She goes, great. We talked about consent today. And I'm like,
oh. I do not look forward to that.
it's a different world in that they have so much more access to more information than we had at their age. Mm-hmm. And you have to address it. You can't ignore it. And so there I am with my 15, 16-year-old daughter. I just deferred to Neri and said, well,
well, speaking of being a dad, Crowy, and I mean, I know it's a personal subject for you and probably the biggest challenge that you've faced in your life, but could you provide the listeners a bit of an update on so far as Ozzy's health and yeah, maybe for some listeners that don't know, yeah, provide a bit of context for what's happened and maybe provide some ways that people can support with any charities or anything that you're involved with?
Yeah, mate. Thank you for asking. I'm never scared or shy to talk about Ozzy and what happened. For those people who don't know, September the 17th in 2022, we're at an athletics carnival at Homebush. Ozzy was on a sporting scholarship at his high school. It's called the GPS Athletics Championships. So there were 10,000 people out there because all the schools send the whole student body out there to watch and cheer. And Ozzy had run his 800 in the morning, ran a PB actually, and was meant to run the 1500 and age up because the boy who was meant to be running it was feeling sick. That boy ended up doing the race. And then after the race, Ozzy and he went for a cool down jog. And yeah, literally 50 meters into that jog, he collapsed and he suffered a spinal stroke at level T2 to T4, spinal level. Very frightening. I was standing there with my two daughters and my best mate's son, who at the time was 18 and he was running for another school about 100 meters away from where it happened. I didn't see it happen. Yeah. Crazy turn of events. Neri was there. We cut a long story very short. We got him to the children's hospital, drove there, or drove to a hospital first, probably broke every driving law possible. He very quickly lost all movement in his lower legs. By the time we got to the children's hospital at Randwick, he'd lost all movement below level T2. So that's the nipple line down, bladder, bowel, everything. And yeah, it became evident. I mean, they treat for everything in the beginning because they're not sure. So he was put on the strongest blood thinner straight away, immunoglobulins, steroids, everything. But the neurologist was pretty sure he knew what it was. And 24 hours later, yeah, it was clear that something had blocked the blood supply to his spine temporarily, probably 4 hours maybe, and quite a substantial portion of his spinal cord, the tissue never recovered. So, so he lives with an incomplete spinal cord injury. Additionally, we thought he was never going to walk again. That's
was one of the very likely outcomes. Crazy time in our life because our eldest daughter, Lucy, was 10 days away from starting the HSC. And I still to this day feel guilty that Neri and I were pretty much living at the hospital for the next 3 months. So Lucy had to fend for herself. We got a lot of support from just our amazing friends, all the junior sporting teams we're parts of. My mum came and lived with us. So good news was Ozzy started moving his toes. Probably the best day in my life, I reckon. I will show you boys the video one day when he started wiggling his toe, because we were just in limbo. The neurologist had said, you want to see something come back, and the quicker it comes back, the better. That tends to speak to a better prognosis. I've never seen anyone lose movement for 5 to 6 weeks and then regain anything. If it's at 5 to 6 week mark, we're still, so, you know, we were sweating bullets every night, hoping that the next day, and then he started wriggling his toes. It was the best day of my life. I filmed it. I sent it off to this other doctor because we'd got him into the hyperbaric chamber and we were trying everything. We were so lucky because of Neri's connection. She'd been an emergency nurse at St. George Hospital for 21 years and then Sutherland Hospital. St. George Hospital is one of the biggest teaching hospitals in Sydney. So a lot of the people she worked with in that 2 decades were now at the kids' hospital. Mate, we got so well looked after. Once they saw, a lot of these doctors saw Austin's name on the list and that, you know, who his mum was, Neri. Well, we had people coming around and Neri, she's just a researcher. She was reaching out to people. We were getting all this feedback about progressive therapies. What should we try? It's very time sensitive because some of this tissue is damaged, but potentially not dead. So we got him in the hyperbaric chamber because Neri had worked with the head of hyperbaric medicine. So the second biggest hyperbaric chamber in the Southern Hemisphere is at the Prince of Wales Adult Hospital, which is next door to the Children's Hospital. And it's crazy because the actual hyperbaric chamber was literally 150 meters from Ozzy's room via this walkway, but the two hospitals don't communicate because one's a adult hospital, one's a kids hospital. But again, Neri just knew how to cut through. The head of hyperbaric medicine at the adult hospital was a professor that Neri had worked with at St. George. Anyways, we got him in the hyperbaric chamber, but there was a bit of pushback because the medical field very much operates like the legal field. It's all based on precedence. Like they're not going to experiment, or they can't. They have to be very clear in the treatments that are well-tested, backed in science and research with double-blinded trials for long periods of time. That's the way the medical field has to operate. And there just wasn't a lot of precedence with a teenage stroke patient. But we got him in. But one of the doctors in the hyperbaric chamber had said, if there's no change, we'll give him 2 sessions. And if there's no change, because normally the protocol is 15 sessions, 15 two-hour sessions. So you can imagine when he moved his toe, I just couldn't get that on video quick enough to show everyone, but also this doctor, like, there is a change. We want the extra 13 sessions in the hyperbaric chamber. So yeah, we ended up getting out of hospital, coming home. He actually got discharged out of a wheelchair. He needed assistance walking, but he was standing and mate, I take my hat off to him. He's such a tough kid. He was rehabbing. The neurologist said to us, because a few people were saying, oh, I think he's doing too much rehab. And I spoke to the neurologist and he said, you're probably going to get pushback from some of the therapists, but this guy was the head guy. And he said to me, stroke rehab is like endurance training. It's about repetition and consistency. The more you do, the better. He said, the little bit of difference is in stroke rehab, sometimes you have to scramble the message or spam the brain with different stimulus. You can't, the brain gets set into a pattern. So you've got to scramble it up. If you're trying to lay down new pathways, you've got to scramble things. So I said, well, what's the worst side effect from too much rehab? He said, oh no, he'll get what's called neural fatigue. He'll be very fatigued and then you'll just sleep. So I said to Oz, mate, you'll get tired. He's like, okay, well, I'll sleep when I'm tired. So we literally set up a gym in his room. He was doing 15 minutes of rehab every hour, in addition to going off to the 2 scheduled sessions. And we had amazing help. We had amazing therapists. But mate, you talk about you know, we are who we are and things that shape us. And am I black and white? And, you know, what I saw with Ozzy, and I'd seen it before, but he was one of the eldest in the ward. We're in the neurology ward. The oncology ward was next door. And sadly, a lot of the kids are younger than he was. He was 13. There was some his age and a bit older, but most were younger. And mate, I would walk in some days and Austin was giving the younger kids rides around the ward on his wheelchair. And he was like the king of the kids in there. And I said to him, well, look at this kid with everything he's going through. What a kid. And I mean, we're all completely our kids' biggest cheerleaders. But I'd seen it with him prior to that when I used to coach his soccer team when they were younger. You know, we're playing this team one day and there was a kid from the other team who's, you know, there's always a kid who's bigger and stronger and more developed than the other kids. And he was rolling our kids like 10 pins. They were going everywhere. And I said to the other dad who was coaching said to me, someone needs to lay a hit on that kid. And I'm like, looking through our roster thinking, who's it going to be? Anyway, this big kid ended up going in for a tackle on the other coach's son and he went rolling. And I saw Austin running towards it. I thought, oh, Ozzy's bristled up here. He's going to have a crack at this kid. Anyway, he ran right past the kid to check on his mate on the ground. All still in play. And I've said, Ozzy, what are you doing? And he said, Dad, I'm checking on my mate. And I just looked at Neri and she just went, that's who he is.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But anyway, back to the story. Yeah, he's doing good, man. We actually got him categorized 2 weekends ago so we can try doing some para sport. He's got a lot of function back. I mean, the crazy thing is I grew up or lived as an athlete and then, you know, my daughter's on a running scholarship in college. My son was on a sporting college. Actually, his was a dual scholarship because he's smart. His was an academic / sporting scholarship. And then when this first happens, you think, oh, what's that mean for sport? And then as the days pass and you actually realize the gravity of the situation, you think, what's this really mean for life and his relationships moving forward, his quality of your life and all of those things. So he can move around. He still gets tired a lot. I mean, we've got him back playing soccer. He's back playing soccer and, you know, his movement's nowhere near what it was. And, he gets tired quickly. But we got him back surfing, which for me is a huge win. He loves surfing. He was a great surfer and he just loves it. And you know, you get locked in this routine of rehab and, you know, we as athletes, sometimes training is boring, right? But you know, there's a payoff coming. You're preparing for an event. You're going to get to scratch that competitive itch. There's a payoff coming, whether it be in a performance in a race or you can see the continuous improvement, whatever. You know, a 13, 14, 15-year-old, the way he was just going to rehab and, you know, for the first 12 months, it was twice a day. Then it's once a day and still once a day. We still do one session a day. And during the school holidays, you know, the neurologist has said to us, you got to overload at different times of the year. And so the only time we really had time to do that was in the school holidays. So we do these intensive rehab sessions back to back. So, you know, the kid didn't have a school holiday for 2 years. He just went and did his rehab, never complained. And so, yeah, he's doing well. But we wanted him to get back to, he's a competitor. He likes to compete. So we thought it was suggested to us and we floated the idea with him and said, you know, if you get categorized, it means you compete against other people who are categorized with the same level of dysfunction as you. So it's a level playing field, so to speak. But more importantly, you just get to train with purpose and with process again, which is how he used to love that. So, and the lessons that you get from competing. We talked about it before, like you're asking me, what are my best results? Sometimes your best performances are an eighth place, but you perform to your level. No one ever talks about that, but you learn so much from it. Other times you win races and that's never a bad thing, but you secretly know I've underperformed there. So I think having that process in place, I mean, I know that's he enjoys that competition. So that's where we're at. And I mean, to the charities that you mentioned, Sam, I mean, the crazy irony is I was an ambassador for the Starlight Children's Foundation for a couple of years before we were actually beneficiaries of their amazing work. So it was crazy that we'd been trying to tee up a tour through the Starlight Rooms, and every major children's hospital in Australia has a Starlight Room. And really it's a room set up with a kitchen where you can cook,
baked cookies, there's art and craft, there's computer games, there's music, there's DJs, there's movies, there's trivia quizzes. It's a place where kids go in between all their appointments and the grind of hospital life, and parents go to catch up, have a coffee, and just to feel a little bit of normality, really, and a bit of happiness, happy. Talk about the impact, the mind-body connection, just being happy, feeling normal. It's the work they do is amazing. So we've been trying to tee up a tour of either the room at Westmead or Randwick, but because of COVID restrictions, we couldn't. And then crazily, Ozzy had his stroke and we ended up in there. And I saw all the people in there and they're like, man, what are you doing in here? I'm like, well, I'm in here with my son. And so, yeah, I'm still an ambassador for that charity. They run fundraising drives all year. They've got their Starlight Super Swim. So anyone listening who's into swimming, you want to, you know, log a few laps and get people to sponsor you, how many laps you can clock up. And they also have their cycling challenge in, it's usually September. I think it's going to be October this year. So look out for that. I see where the money goes. It goes into these amazing rooms and facilities. And actually the Children's Hospital at Randwick, we got a tour. They always invite us back. They actually call Ozzy the Miracle Man. And we go back there and they're opening up a new huge section of the hospital. And there's going to be a new Starlight room in there. So we'll go in there for the opening of the room. We still go back. Actually, we're going in tomorrow. We go back every 6 months for appointments. We always go back and visit them in the Starlight room. So you're one of the charities that I'm aligned with, which cut close to home because we ended up in the Starlight. We were in there. The Alexanders actually dominated. I think we were unbeaten at FIFA and at trivia quizzes we were unbeaten as well. So they know of us. Our reputation precedes us there.
Oh, it's good to... Obviously, everyone that knew you was pretty hard to hear about it all. And then to, you know, for me, the most amazing part is just Ozzy's mindset. You know, I just think to not become a victim in that situation, like in your own mindset, is something that's pretty remarkable. And, you know, like we said, some things are just, some people just have certain characteristics, some they become who they are because of their environment, but it sounds like he's just sort of, obviously he's always had supportive parents, but it sounds like he's always been what they say, you know, a very, just a good human, a bit like his dad.
he is a good human. I'm very, very biased, but I mean, through that time, what becomes clear is the people who reach out to you and support you and all you guys did. So I want to thank you for that. It means a lot. You know, you'll be sitting in the hospital, just a message comes through. Our immediate community around here, or I'd come home from the hospital. So Neri and I were switching. She'd do 7 at night till 7 in the morning. And I'd do 7 in the morning till 7 at night. And I'd get home at 8:30 in the evening. People had left meals at our front door. People were just amazing. Yeah, just amazing. You know, so... they're the things that come out of those things. And yeah, Ozzy's doing good. I mean, when you're in those situations, you hear people say all the time, and it's a cliche to say, it gives you real perspective, but it does, because we're in a hospital that was packed with children. And on a scale of who was the sickest or who was, and you never want to compare my sickness, but Ozzy was actually ended up being on the good end of the spectrum. Like we left, we were discharged. We walked out of there. So you see, it does give you a perspective and you think, wow, man, I mean, you form bonds with the other parents in the tea room up the back of the ward and you hear what they've got going on. And when we discharge, there's almost a feeling of guilt too, that you're leaving that behind and you're just So mate, it's one of those things that you never want to go through it. And it was a terribly unlucky situation, but he ended up, you know, batting above in terms of what his prognosis could have been. And he just, kids are so resilient, you know, they don't have the baggage that we have. They don't have the, like, even in there, like you just, all the kids, they're in there and they're happy and they got stuff going on. And, you know, sometimes I think as parents, we drag them down. We do. And it's hard not to, because just, you know, it's your baby there. And it's just, but I mean, I remember one day just saying to Oz, mate, I wish I could switch places with you. And he said, nah, you wouldn't want to, Dad. And I just thought, you know what? He's going to be okay. He is. He's just, I wouldn't have handled it anywhere near as well as he did. I didn't handle it as well as Neri did. Neri was just so strong. But he's doing good, and he's taken on other things. He's playing guitar now. So he and I get a little jam on, and he's performed at the school rock concert this year. They
awesome.
They picked, when they were doing their song selection, they picked The Angels, "Am I Ever Going to See Your Face Again?" And I said, "Mate, I don't think you should be doing that one. There's going to be some crowd involvement there." And he's like, no, we've got the sign off from the head of music and the principal. And sure enough, at the rock concert, they come out on stage and someone comes out and makes a speech and says, "Look, we don't want to hear what you would normally hear in this song." And yeah.
So for any non-Australian listeners, it basically, "Are we ever going to see your face again?" And then it says, "You can beep it." Like, what does it say?
No. Yeah, it says, "No way, get fucked."
Fuck off.
Yeah.
So the principal came out and said, "You've got to say, if you want to chant back, you've got to say, no way, get stuffed, sod off." That's what they said. Say that.
Sure enough, the first chorus rolls around and you know what they said. And I'm just looking around thinking, are they going to get shut down here? Are they going to pull the
plug
on this? But no, he's doing good.
Pete Murray did that at the finish line at Port Macquarie this year. "Oh, we can have that song, but no one's allowed to swear."
Yeah.
And then it was like everyone's just screaming the F-bombs. Poor little kids around. Just
part of Australian culture.
That's so cool. So he was the singer and guitarist in that, Crowe?
So last year they did Red Hot Chili Peppers. What Red Hot Chili Peppers song did they do? Scar Tissue. And he sang and played guitar on that. For the Angels, he was just guitarist. So but he hasn't got a bad little voice, although he's you know what's have dropped recently, so he's gone down a couple of scales.
Sporadically, up and down.
Yeah.
Oscar's just starting to go through that, and it brought back so many memories. It is such a awkward time of your life. You know, even I remember just thinking when the breaking voice was at its worst, you're just like, "I don't know if I want to say anything here because it could come out any which way." And you're like, "I'll give it a go."
For Appo, that was his early 20s.
Yeah. Well, Crowe, we are super grateful for your time. I should point out that, Crowe, you've obviously got a very successful large coaching business as well. Do you want to talk about that at all? We can.
No, we don't have to. It's not that large and it's not that successful.
Just on that note, Crowe, we owe you a couple of checks for the mentions that we've got on the Iron Man Live podcast, on the Iron Man Live coverage, mate. That got sent through one day. I thought something terrible had happened, and it was just everyone screen grabbing you, giving us a mention. So thank you a lot.
I nearly had to take a pin to Clint's head. It was just expanding by the second. I was like, "Dude, settle down."
We just wanted you to plug your coaching business so we could plug RPG and not feel like shills, Crowe.
Boys, you know, I'm always happy to. I mean, we go a long way back. As a lot of people in this sport, we've all grown up together, so it's the least I could do. But you know, we've got the coaching business. My role in the business is really to go to camps. I go to camps. We've had two in Kona this year, one in Mallorca. And actually, I fly out next Tuesday. We've got one in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. So, and when I say my role in the business is to go to all the camps, I actually didn't go to Mallorca this year, so I don't go to all of them. But
I could just see it, Crowe, like you going to the camp and then everyone thinking they're going to train with you and you just getting your competitive, the angry dog's still deep within, and I could imagine you still push it in a few sessions.
I'm competitive. I think that's wired into me. Although I must say I haven't, other than a Concept 2 bike at the gym I go to, I haven't ridden a bike since our Kona camp in March. So, and our Kona camp in March, I hadn't ridden a bike since the Tour de Kids Challenge the previous September, where I had to lead a ride a week. So, but I'm still, I mean, Lucy's just been home for 3 months. She's flying back with me next Tuesday. I've been running with her 3 times a week. I go to the gym. When Ozzy does his rehab, I rip in, and proud to say I've got a few gym records up on the wall there for their workout of the week.
They have weight classes, do they? So featherweight bench press.
Mate, on the featherweight, yeah, there's a few big boys in there. And it's hard to match their power when you take out gravity and aerodynamics, even on the Concept 2 bikes. But yeah, no, you guys know it's when it's wide into you, mainly just exercising. I love it. It's part of my routine. I surf with Oz a couple of times a week. I was paddling a ski there for a while, but yeah, no, I'll always exercise. And if it's a competitive environment, yeah, for sure. you don't have to scratch the surface too deeply to find that monster hiding down in there somewhere.
Yeah. Well, we're really stoked to have you on, Crowy. We might get you on another time, even just to chat potentially about a big race coming up, or I've always wanted to do like a live, you know how they do like live watch parties for MMA, Clint? We could sit around, yeah, maybe crack a beer or two and chat through, you know, an Ironman race, giving out.
Just not do the all-nighters with Reed, all right, Crowy? We'll choose a daytime one, mate.
Yeah, like an alternate commentary or something like that.
Yeah, we might all lose our employment with Ironman, though. But
possibly pre-Nice or Hawaii, Reed. We could.
Yeah, it would be awesome, yeah, because you've always got such good insights. I think, you know, we've already mentioned it, but when you're on the commentary, I think you do a fantastic job, so we'll try and steal that and add it to the show. Thank you, mate. It was really interesting listening, and yeah, can't thank you enough for coming on.
Appreciate the time, boys. Always good to chat. Love to your better halves and all your other halves. I shouldn't say better halves. I get my ass kicked for that. And families. And I'm sure we'll cross paths in the flesh somewhere soon enough.
Sounds good. Thanks, mate. Apo, Clint, can you stay on the line? We'll just record a couple of quick ads. And Crowy, you are free to go, mate.